Good afternoon and welcome to what is going to be a very interesting and exciting discussion here today for the next 2 hours. I'm Mike Forgare and I'm a Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at Thomas Jefferson University. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to the 21st Annual Dr. Raymond C. Grandin Lecture. 4 years ago, I had the pleasure of presiding over the opening of the Grandin Center here on campus, over in the third floor of the Curtis Building. And we have been benefiting from that center ever since. We're truly grateful for the forward thinking and generosity of the Grandin family that has made this lectureship, that facility, and the momentum for the School of Population Health possible. Unfortunately, Dr. Grandin and his wife, Doris, are not able to be with us in person here today, but we will be recording this event and sharing it with them. But we'd be remiss if we didn't take some time to acknowledge Ray's tremendous accomplishments and the Grandin's outstanding generosity to Jefferson and support for both the center that bears his name, the School of Population Health, and many students who have benefited from all of his advice and support over the years. Dr. Grandin is one of those unique figures in medicine. He earned his MD at Jefferson in 1945, served in the U.S. Army between his internship and residency in internal medicine. As a medical student, he began to show interest in population health with a specific focus on cardiology. And he actually created a cardiovascular discussion group. Sounds like interprofessional collaboration and team building back then, doesn't it? They held evening cardiac clinics, and he encouraged physicians of different disciplines and other staff to sit and talk about the issue of rheumatic heart disease. He was responsible for the first televised heart operation in the United States, broadcasted from Jefferson. He also helped coordinate the nation's first commercially successful cardiac rehabilitation program, utilizing graded exercise with continuous oscilloscopic monitoring. Dr. Grandin remains active in our community. He served as president of our chapters of the Alumni Association. And in 2000, through his generous contribution from he and his family, he endowed a professorship here, the Dr. Raymond C. and Doris N. Grandin Professorship in Health Policy, which set us on our way to creating the Jefferson Medical College Department of Health Policy, and then now the School of Population Health. So we have many reasons to be thankful to Dr. Grandin and his family and their forward-looking approach to supporting this university. But we are most thankful to him for putting our focus on healthcare and the population. And today, this is a very, very timely focus for all of us. So it's my pleasure now to introduce to you Dr. Nash, our founding dean for the School of Population Health, and he will introduce today's program.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. Mike, thanks very much. It's wonderful to see this beautiful auditorium practically filled to capacity. And it's a very special day for us, the 21st Grandin Lecture. As I was joking with our team this morning, only two people have perfect attendance at all 21 lectures. And that's me and Bob Neroni, the photographer. So round of applause for Bob Neroni. On a more serious note, imagine where we were 20 years ago. So no one was tweeting about the Grandin Lecture like we are right now. And you can follow us at hashtag pound JSPH, Jefferson School of Population Health. And our very own team is hard at work out there in the Twittersphere telling everybody about our program. Also, you'll be getting an email from us with a link to all of the slides that Dr. McClellan will be presenting. And finally, right now, we're simultaneously broadcasting this entire program on the Jefferson video system. All of that technology, of course, none of it existed 20 years ago when we got started. I'm also especially proud that this 21st lecture is being brought to you by our now 3-year-old School of Population Health, as Mike Verghere alluded to. When we were approved by the board in July of 2008, and we opened the doors to our school on 9/9/09, so we're coming up on our third birthday this fall. We now have our 4 master's degrees program, our doctoral program, our research efforts. I'm incredibly proud and very privileged to be a part of the beginning and growth of this amazing program on our campus. I want to take a moment to acknowledge the support of a lot of very special people who made our school possible, especially our outgoing president, Dr. Bob Barchi. Bob really had the prescient vision through an on-campus strategic planning process, and I remember very much the fateful day in October 2007 when Bob said to me, "I want you to create a new school on our campus." And I said, "Well, that sounds like a great idea. Let me go home and think about it." And many of you know Bob. He looked at his watch, and he said, "You have 5 minutes to decide whether this is a good idea or not, because if you don't do it, I'll get somebody else to do it." It was a very quick decision in October 2007. Many of the same people who helped create the school are here in the audience today, and to all of them, I am incredibly grateful for your support. Let me outline today's proceedings. In just a moment, I'll have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Mark McClellan. As is our custom, we will immediately, following Mark's comments, I'll ask our 4 panelists to come forward. I will introduce them at that point in time, and they will give their extemporaneous comments to Mark's presentation, and then hopefully we'll have an opportunity to open the floor to questions. I'm committed to keeping us on schedule and to ending no later than 2 o'clock this afternoon. Let me turn now to the beautiful brochures that you were all handed when you came in the door. I hope you'll have the opportunity to review Dr. Grandin's history that Mike Verghere just outlined. And, of course, I hope you'll have an opportunity to read the wonderful bio sketch about Mark McClellan. Let me see if I could personalize Mark's introduction for you. So I believe that Mark McClellan represents really the epitome of physician participation in public service. Mark has spanned all of the arenas available, basically, where doctors can make a contribution, from academic medicine and practice to research and to public service and back again. I think it's very rare to find a physician who has led both the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the FDA, who brought with him a very deep understanding of the doctor-patient relationship. And in these powerful roles, Mark made an important contribution truly to the well-being of our country. Mark has also served through the political waters in 2 different administrations and 2 different White Houses. And now as the director of the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform and on the Leonard Schaefer Chair in Health Policy Studies, both at Brookings, Mark is able to finally, I think, speak his mind and give us his personal views of the issues that face our country as it relates to healthcare. Mark, today you join a wonderful pedigree, and as the folks who have the brochures in front of them think back through who some of the previous lecturers were, most recently Mike McAllister from Humana and a long list of illustrious folks who have been at this podium and other podium on our campus. So I know that you're going to do a great job, and I know with the hearings coming up this summer and with the nation's attention turned to healthcare, I couldn't think of a better time and a better guy to address these issues at this wonderful university than Mark McClellan. Please join me in welcoming Mark McClellan to campus.
David, thanks very much for that introduction. I'd also like to thank Mike Verghere and all of you here, especially the School of Population Health, but all of you here at Jefferson who are taking time out of what I know are very busy schedules to be part of this event today. It is a very special privilege for me to fit into this 21-year tradition with David and Bob and those distinguished previous lecturers on important issues relating to improving our healthcare system. This is something that Dr. Grandin obviously viewed as a key part of not only his career, but of his legacy to the school, the university, to help all of you recognize the importance of leadership in improving our healthcare system. And that's something I want to talk to you about today. I know many of you here are in white coats or involved in clinical practice. One of the main themes from my remarks today is that for our next round of healthcare reform to succeed, it's going to require even more leadership from the health professions in finding ways to get to better care at a lower cost. So I'm going to go through the, I'm going to finish my own introductory comments on these learning objective slides and then turn next to what I'd like to discuss. I want to also give a special thanks to the mayor's office and Don's here. Over the years, I've had a chance to work with the city of Philadelphia, both at CMS and in some of our subsequent activities. I recently co-chaired a commission for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation on building a healthier America, which emphasized that the main ways in which we can improve health are through steps that are outside of traditional health care, by helping to promote better population health through changes in behavior, changes in our neighborhoods. And that's something that means a lot to Mayor Nutter and the leadership of the city here. So this is a great place and a great set of panelists to comment on the topics for today's discussion. And also a special thanks to the other panelists. You know, David Nash has made a big point to all of you that, well, you don't get to see the slides beforehand. You got to do extemporaneous comments. What he may not have told you was I didn't give him the final slides for this presentation until last night. So this all works out well. That way the discussion is up to date. So what I want to spend a few minutes on is starting out with where we are on healthcare reform and the kinds of things that people routinely ask me to talk about. What's the Supreme Court going to do? What happens under different scenarios for election outcomes with respect to the Affordable Care Act and so forth. And spend a few minutes on that. But what I really want to emphasize is some fundamentals that will, I think, drive the next steps in healthcare reform in this country, regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court, regardless of who wins the next election. I know it's the most important election of our lifetime, and this is a hugely important, it's one of the most watched decisions by the Supreme Court in a generation. But there are some deeper fundamentals affecting where our healthcare system is headed that are going to be there regardless of those political and policy events, and that really demand, I think, more leadership from the clinical community and more steps to try to get to the goals of a high-value healthcare system. And so that's what I'm going to spend the last few minutes of my comments talking about. Now, this slide may be a little bit hard to read depending on where you are in the room and not on the size of the type on your handouts, but I'm an economist, so I like to start with a slide about the financial numbers. This is a projection of, past trends and future projections of the federal budget in the United States divided into three categories. There's healthcare entitlements of the federal budget, so Medicare, the federal part of Medicaid after 2014, which is right about there, the new subsidies for people to buy health insurance on the exchanges under the ACA, that's this red part. This goes back to 1970 and projects about a century forward. So that's the red part, the healthcare spending. Light blue is Social Security. So that's the federal spending to support the Social Security program. The dark blue is everything else that the federal government spends money on. So that's all of national defense, all discretionary spending, research, infrastructure, education, and everything else. And what you can see is, it's not a big surprise, but the growth in healthcare costs have become a bigger and bigger part of federal spending. And looking forward, at least on the spending side, of the deficit challenges that our country is facing, and similar challenges are true in other developed countries as well. But on the spending side, we're going to be spending more over the next 20 years with the retirement of the baby boom on Social Security. That's going to go up by about a percentage of GDP, maybe from close to 5% to close to 6%. But the real story is healthcare, where we're spending about 5% of the nation's entire gross domestic product output on federal healthcare programs now. And that's projected to go up by about 3 or 4 percentage points, depending on whose projections you believe, over the next 20, 25 years while the baby boom retires. Everything else, at least under current law projections, is going to decline as a share of federal expenditures. And you've seen this happen over the past years as well, as healthcare spending and Social Security spending have risen. You know, we've had about 18% of GDP overall for most of our modern history. Spending on everything else has been gradually getting squeezed down. And that's an issue for setting and determining national priorities going forward as well. You know, it's the big blip here. This was the Great Recession, 2008, so a huge increase in spending related to financial bailouts, the economic stimulus legislation, and so forth. That's the upside right there. We are sitting right about here right now, just on the edge of that plateau, overlooking what in Washington is called now the fiscal cliff, that's scheduled to come in at the beginning of 2013. So this is a combination of things that are going to be disruptive for the economy. It's the expiration of the stimulus spending and the imposition of the new sequestration on federal spending. Remember, Congress passed the Deficit Reduction Act last July, which is another trillion reduction in spending across the board, including in Medicare. At the same time, the so-called Bush-era tax cuts are all scheduled to expire for low-income on up through very wealthy Americans. At the same time, a current tax break for Social Security contributions is scheduled to expire. Put all those together, that's about a 2% or so impact on the nation's GDP directly. That's why a lot of economists are saying, well, if we're not teetering on the edge of a recession again now, these reductions in government spending combined with the increases in taxes at the beginning of 2013 are going to have an adverse macroeconomic effect. What that means is that sometime before or near the beginning of 2013, Congress is going to be doing something to address that cliff and the tax increases that go along with it. And what that means is there's going to be even more pressure on federal spending related to the health care programs because we're going to have to do something something's going to happen to offset some of that that scheduled cliff reduction and non-health care related spending that's coming. And within this spending and health care, you know, this looks big and scary, but a lot of it's just due to expansion, to changing demographics in this country and to the expansions of coverage under Medicaid and on the exchanges. With the Affordable Care Act, there were some changes in physician payment and other health care provider payment to pay for some of the coverage expansions. You know, the bill was estimated to cost about $1 trillion over its first 10 years, mainly for the coverage expansion starting in 2014. That was partly paid for by fee and tax increases mainly on the wealthy, fees on, say, device companies, health insurance companies, and the like, about $500 billion worth there, and another $500 billion from sort of the old-fashioned way of getting savings in healthcare programs, and that's squeezing the payment rates to providers. So this is a chart of what happened with the last big deficit reduction legislation in this country, the Balanced Budget Act of 1998. That's what brought us the so-called sustainable growth rate, SGR, for physician payment. People basically familiar with SGR. So this is what, according to formula, says that if physician spending in Medicare grew by more than GDP plus 1%, there will be an automatic across-the-board reduction in payment rates to physicians. And starting in 2002, when the economy wasn't growing so well and healthcare costs were, under the law, there's been a 5% three-year reduction, and under changes in the law, that's increased. Congress typically does step in at the last minute and head off a big reduction, or has done so in every year since 2003. But for those of you who are in physician practice, you know that the payments they're actually getting have not kept up with inflation. Inflation is this line, that's kind of top line up here. Actual physician payments have hovered more around zero in growth rates in nominal terms, which means in terms of real prices, they've been getting squeezed down. Now, that approach in kind of a moderated form is the same thing that the ACA builds in for other healthcare providers as well. So the new normal for updates in payment rates for every provider other than physicians who are already facing the SGR is no longer the so-called market basket or inflation rate, but market basket minus 1.1%. And I say, well, 1.1%, that's not that big of a deal. You know, it's 1% in payments, but 1.1% compounded every year starting in 2013 to 2015, 2019, that adds up to real money. And that's where that $500 billion, a good part of that $500 billion in savings projected under the law to pay for the coverage expansions comes from. So that's our tried and true approach to trying to control healthcare costs. When other approaches don't fail, when we need to do something in terms of trying to make coverage more available and affordable, squeeze down the payment rates to providers. And this is a chart from work by Michael Chernew at Harvard, kind of putting this in perspective for the history of the Medicare program, the history of spending control efforts. Medicare historically has grown on a per capita basis significantly faster than the overall rate of growth of the economy as a whole, somewhere around 1.5-2%. Under current law, so without any further changes, with that big increase in the red area of our budget chart that I showed you before, we have policies in place for payments to physicians and other healthcare providers that are going to, if projections are right, keep payments to providers at a level that will actually reduce the per capita spending in the Medicare program on average by about 0.5% per year for the next decade. That's a level of tightening in financing that we have never been able to come close to achieving before in the Medicare program, and that is without accounting for the additional fiscal pressures that are going to be facing Medicare starting in 2013 with that, you know, we're really entering this era of deficit reduction legislation, that big cliff that I showed you before, the big red areas going forward. So the debate heading into 2013 is really getting tougher. It's not going to be so much, you know, how can we restore these payment reductions, but rather how can we get even more savings out of the Medicare programs and the healthcare programs that the federal government is participating in. And this exercise that I've gone through on the federal side is mirrored on the state side, as you all know. You can do a similar chart showing growth in state expenditures and projected growth, what's happened over time with the states. Medicaid spending and healthcare spending has been increasing in real terms. Other programs, per capita spending on infrastructure, on education, and so forth, have been getting squeezed and are projected to get squeezed even more in the future. So this is meant to be sobering, a sobering context for the debates that are coming about healthcare. Yes, we've had some tough debates about affordability of care so far, and yes, there's been a lot of pressure under current law on healthcare providers to keep costs down through the tighter price regulations, the tighter payments that are coming, but that's going to get a lot more challenging in the years ahead. So in that context, I want to talk a little bit about the healthcare legislation and the next steps there. So as you all know, there's a big Supreme Court decision due out around the end of June where the Supreme Court is going to rule on, among other things, the constitutionality of the individual mandate requirement for purchasing health insurance under the ACA, going to rule if that is unconstitutional, whether or not that provision is severable from the rest of the law, and also going to rule on state challenges to the Medicaid expansions under the law as well. And let's have a little audience participation. How many of you all think that the Supreme Court is going to uphold the entire law? I'm glad that you all have been following this really good jurisprudence today. So a good number of hands went up then. How about overturning the individual mandate only? Okay, so that's probably a majority of hands. I'd probably put my hand up, odds on in that area too. Individual mandate and other provisions that are tightly linked to it, at least on both the government and the states who are opposing the law, argued that if the court's going to overturn the mandate, it should also overturn the guaranteed issue and community rating, the insurance market reform requirements that were the reason for putting the individual mandate in. I think the court will link those two. See, a few hands going up there. It really depends on how the court thinks about severability of specific provisions. The federal government clearly has the authority to regulate insurance markets and impose things like guaranteed issue and community rating. The real question, if you're taking a narrow view of constitutionality, the real question is just about does the Commerce Clause apply to, you know, inaction or the non-purchase of private insurance? Medicaid overturn? Really, few people there. I think most of the observers think that's not going to happen. As to paraphrase Chief Justice Roberts is like, well, what were you expecting the federal government to do when they gave you a lot of money to support Medicaid expansions other than, you know, impose some conditions along with it? So, you know, we'll see what happens. I think the odds are that, again, close call, but I think the odds are that at least the individual mandate might be overturned. But I want to come back to why that may be less important than some people might think. And then we have an election coming up in November, which will be a very important election. Let me go through a couple of scenarios fairly quickly. One is the event of a across-the-board Republican win. So Mitt Romney wins the presidency. The Republicans take control of the Senate, 50-51 votes, and they retain control of the House. In that case, Republicans have been very clear about what they want to do. They want to repeal the law. Now, repealing the entire law is not as simple as it seems. Let's say, for sake of argument, the Supreme Court doesn't overturn any of it, so they're left with some real work to do. To the extent the Supreme Court overturns pieces of it or all of it, that repeal job is easier. The Republicans would use the same mechanism that the final version passed the Senate in order to overturn provisions in the law, and that's the so-called reconciliation procedure in the Senate, where you only need 51 or 50-plus the vice president votes rather than the usual 60. Reconciliation applies to legal provisions, to legislative provisions that have a direct and significant federal budgetary impact, positive or negative. It doesn't apply necessarily to every provision of the law, and that's why the final version of the ACA that passed the Senate wasn't the, you know, more ideal version that, that the Democratic supporters might have liked to pass in the first place. So what can you get rid of with reconciliation? You can get rid of the mandate. The Congressional Budget Office, the official budget scores, have said that would have a significant savings effect in itself. If you just get rid of the mandate, that's estimated to have two effects. One is fewer people sign up for coverage, so that the government is paying out less in subsidies. The second effect is that the people who do sign up are likely to be a bit sicker on average. That was the reason for putting the mandate in there in the first place, right? So that would tend to make subsidies higher, according to at least the government actuaries. The first effect is bigger than the second, so that's a net saver and could be done under the reconciliation process. Also, the subsidies for purchasing health insurance in the exchanges, the Medicaid expansions could either be delayed or repealed. What couldn't be repealed, though, through reconciliation is the insurance market reforms. And on top of that, not only do those provisions not have a direct budgetary impact, the guaranteed issue and community rating, on top of that, they're the most popular provisions in the law. They're supported even by a majority of Republican voters. So from a political standpoint, it's going to be difficult to overturn that particular provision anyway. So let's leave that hanging for a second, and I want to talk about what would happen with a Democratic victory. So Democratic victory, at least President Obama, even if he doesn't keep control of the Senate, basically means the core of the law stays intact, or at least the core of the law that's not addressed by the Supreme Court's decision on overturning potentially pieces of it. If that happens, then we're going to be continuing on with the march towards implementation, which is a very difficult march. Part of my job when I was at CMS, as David mentioned, and between 2004 and 2006, was implementing the Medicare reform law, in particular the prescription drug benefit and some of the other changes to Medicare that happened at the same time. I can tell you that implementing these changes in federal law are not easy. They involve a lot of interaction between new federal systems, new state systems. In this case, and it's just 10 times harder, 100 times harder than what we had to do for the Medicare drug benefit, including things like setting up the basic rules for insurance exchanges to function and the information exchange needed for that, defining essential benefits, what has to be covered, figuring out how to determine who's eligible for subsidies and what level they're eligible for in close to real time, since people are going to need to have confident information about how much they're going to get subsidized their decisions about coverage, working with states on parallel or integrated enrollment in Medicaid as is required under the law. All of those are very challenging things to do and are going to be, I would say at this point, difficult to implement on schedule, particularly in some of the states that have not been moving forward on their end on updating systems, putting exchanges in place, and the like. So where does that lead you in case of a Democratic victory? Well, anything that would fundamentally change the law is certainly going to be vetoed by President Obama during his second term. He wants this
initiative, this piece of legislation to succeed. It's his, if anything, it's his, what he wants to be, his signature success. But if not all these systems are in place, and not everybody knows in fall of 2013, which is only a year or so away from now, exactly what they need to do to sign up for coverage and exactly what their costs are going to be, if the available plans aren't quite as available in every state as we'd like, it's a very common thing that Congress tends to do in that situation, or that the administration can do through its own administrative action, and that's maybe go a bit slow on implementing some of the provisions of the law. What's the provision that's most likely that Congress and the administration will be going slow on implementing? The least popular one, which is the mandate. So under current law, the mandate is phased in over 2 years anyway. It doesn't ever get to a very big number relative to the projected cost of health insurance. And so even if the Supreme Court doesn't overturn it, and even if President Obama wins re-election and proceeds as effectively as he can with implementing the law, I think it's very likely that we're not going to see the implementation of a meaningful individual mandate, at least anytime soon, in conjunction with the implementation of all these health care reforms. That has some real implications, I think, for how to move forward with health care reform in this country. And just to go back to what I was talking about with the Republicans a minute ago, Governor Romney has said he supports in terms of health care reform includes things like an expansion of guaranteed issue and community rating, at least for people who are continuously enrolled in insurance. If they leave their job, if they go from one job to another, even if they're in the individual insurance market, he thinks they should continue to be able to get more affordable coverage. All that means that regardless of what the Supreme Court does, and regardless of who wins the election, we're going to have to find a way to make insurance choice work more affordably in an era of increasingly personalized and predictable medicine in the absence, I think, of a strong mandate, regardless of who wins, regardless of what the Supreme Court does. Also going forward, regardless of who wins, regardless of what the Supreme Court does, is a lot of those projected savings in the Medicare program. So those Medicare payment squeezes that I talked about before, they're built into the ACA. They're the main way or a main way of financing the coverage expansions. Even if the Republicans win and overturn other provisions of the law, the Republicans have said that they need savings in Medicare to get us on a more sustainable budget path. So in Paul Ryan's budget, most, if not all, of those Medicare payment changes are preserved. They just don't go to coverage expansions. They go to deficit reduction. They go to making it easier for the federal government to afford to continue to pay for the reformed Medicare entitlement in the future. So those payment squeezes and the pressures caused by that big growing red area that I showed you on the earlier chart, those are there too, no matter what happens. And so that's what I mean by fundamentals that are going to be there, regardless of the Supreme Court, regardless of the election outcome, which brings me to the main thing I want to talk about in the rest of my time with you, which is how are we going to deal with that challenge? Now, there is a traditional approach to healthcare cost challenges, and that's what happened in the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, as I talked about before, which led to the SGR, and that's what was included in the ACA as a way to offset the cost of coverage expansions, and we can't find a better way to get lower healthcare spending. The final common pathway is squeeze the payment rates to providers. Now, this by itself, unfortunately, as you all in medical practice know, doesn't do anything necessarily to improve the quality of care, improve the efficiency of care. If anything, it means that some services are going to be even more unprofitable and difficult to do. We've heard about the pressures on things like spending time with patients, coordinating care, and so forth as a result of tighter payments. And there are a number of studies suggesting that you end up getting more of the treatments that are relatively favorably reimbursed under these fee-for-service systems. Now, there is an alternative, and that is also part of the new Medicare law. It's part of what many states that are led by both Republican as well as Democratic governors are trying, and what many private insurers and employers are trying as well, and that's to change the way that healthcare payments work, to move away from the traditional approaches that we've had in this country, which have mainly been based on fee-for-service payment, and the regulations and the benefit designs that go along with it, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, and instead move towards paying more directly for what we really want in healthcare, and that's some version of better results, better health, at a lower overall cost. So reforming financing to support care reforms is what I want to spend most of the rest of my time talking about, and this gets to this notion of accountability, and I think probably many of you have heard of the, you know, phrases like accountable care organizations and so forth. There are a lot of sort of technical details and jargon there, but the key point, the main thing that I want to get across about this is that the focus is on paying for what we really want, and what that means is some new kinds of risks or some new kinds of accountability facing healthcare professionals and, to some extent, patients. It's not like healthcare professionals are living a life without risk, without financial risk today. If you think about it, many of the things that you're doing all day long are not things that you get compensated for in the insurance programs and the payment systems that you're part of today. What this approach would do, though, is maybe is shift to some extent the kinds of things that are paid for, the kinds of things that aren't, with the goal of getting towards better alignment between the kind of care that we'd like to provide, the best care at the lowest cost, and the way that our financing systems, our benefit designs, our provider payment systems, our regulations are set up. And there are some feasible ways to get there. And this is a little bit different approach than where even I started out in this talk. You know, the usual approach to talking about healthcare reform begins with a chart like the one that I showed you before, saying we're facing a really scary, unsustainable budget outlook, so we have to do something to get costs down. That approach to healthcare reform is really and understandably scary for the American public, because when they think about healthcare cost control, they think about rationing, they think about losing access to quality care, they think about losing access to the providers they need, and it's understandably a very difficult conversation to have, a very difficult basis for driving healthcare reform. So what I'm advocating here is a different approach, but one that depends on people who are involved in healthcare taking more active leadership in getting to where we need to go, taking on the accountability and the responsibility for addressing those rising costs and helping to find a feasible path to get there. This starts with what I would call real healthcare reform, which is not what happens in Washington. It's not when you change the policies and the financing, although those are really important influences on how healthcare is delivered, as we'll talk about in a minute. Real healthcare reform is what you all do every day. It's what you do to help your patients prevent chronic diseases in the first place. It's what you do to identify ways in which you can work with other providers or use medications or new technologies, telemedicine, smartphones, whatever, to deliver care more efficiently for chronic diseases, to coordinate care effectively, to focus in your efforts on patients that need it the most, to make target therapies and combinations of therapies more targeted rather than blunt instruments that are often inefficient, to find ways to prevent readmissions, to prevent surgical infections, to use the checklist, to get the complications rates down in the hospital, to get people out sooner and more effectively when they do need intensive care. All of those things. There are, you know, thousands, millions of steps where every healthcare provider I've talked to, and I'm not in practice anymore, wish I was, but I definitely spend a lot of my time talking to the people who are, have identified ways in which they're not doing it. Our system's not doing it today, and they're not getting supported in doing it. And this is what I mean by a need for a new kind of leadership in healthcare reform, a new kind of clinical leadership, a new kind of leadership that frames healthcare reform on the basis of better care that leads to lower costs, not on the basis of just solving some, fixing some budgetary hole, since this is what I think is ultimately going to succeed in sustainable healthcare reform anyway. There are a lot of obstacles to doing this, but as I'll try to illustrate in the remainder of my remarks, what we need is an alignment between policies that support clinical leadership around a vision for healthcare reform that people can believe in, because it's the right thing to do in terms of how we deliver healthcare, or how we should be delivering healthcare, and we aren't doing it today. A pathway to get our policies aligned with it. So this is something that's, I think, especially difficult and if not unique to healthcare. You know, there are all kinds of management books out there about how to apply, you know, lean production methods or cost accounting and so forth to healthcare. These have been used successfully in other industries to create disruptive change and transformational improvements in products and reductions in costs. The challenge in healthcare is not that there aren't opportunities to do it. There are, and you all are in the position to know best what those opportunities are. It's just that when you take those steps, you don't necessarily get the same kind of support and sustainability that happens more automatically in other industries, where if you deliver a better product at a lower cost, provide a better service at a lower cost, you get more revenues. That's not the way healthcare often works. That's not the way our healthcare financing often works. And so you need a parallel process, along with identifying the clinical change. That's what should lead it, the clinical change. A parallel process for what are the feasible changes in our healthcare policies to make that happen. And that's what many organizations and both federal and state initiatives are trying to do today. It's not easy, but we've got more and more examples of how this can happen successfully. And this all really takes leadership. And by the way, I just want to give a special recognition to Jefferson and the programs that it's starting and expanding in these areas. I mean, many of you are participating in. At Brookings now, we just started a clinician leadership initiative. It was funded by a $10 million grant from a couple of foundations that also believe that this is the right way to go for the future. So hopefully more opportunities, David, to work together on making this happen. So how do you get to real healthcare reform? This is defining those pathways that go along with the clinical improvements. Measurement, payment reform based on the measures, benefit reform based on the measures, and some implications for insurance choice that I may not actually have time to talk about. Let me start with measurement. If you can't measure something, it's awfully hard to support it in policies. And there are some things that we measure really well in healthcare today, and we do a good job of supporting them financially. Things like whether or not you're admitted to the hospital and what diagnosis, and whether or not you had a visit with a particular clinician and what diagnosis, what procedures were performed. Those kinds of measures are the basis of our fee-for-service payment systems that predominate here in the United States. In order to move towards the kinds of reforms and support for the kinds of reforms that I'm talking about, we need a different kind of measures that are more related to and better care at a lower cost, what we really want healthcare to achieve. Some of these are fairly easy to do even with our existing systems. What I call basic measures on this slide are measures that can and are being constructed using electronic data that are available now, including data from health insurance plans, who's got diabetes and which of those patients received some evidence-based types of care, what's going on with total spending on a patient, per capita expenditures. Those are things that we can measure now. Those things are by no means all or even the most important elements of better health, of better quality care. So a lot of efforts around improving care are understandably focusing on getting better information systems in place and getting better measures as a result. So with electronic labs being available, at least from major vendors, systems that are implementing some of these healthcare reforms are doing things like tracking lab results. So if the goal really is not how often you saw your patient with diabetes, but whether or not you are keeping their blood sugar under control, can you track hemoglobin A1C levels? Can you track hospital admissions or emergency room visits for preventable complications related to diabetes? Can you track things like patient experience with care? And you can see where this is headed towards better measures of what really matters to patients. So some of the more advanced healthcare systems for implementing these kinds of reforms are paying more attention to tracking things like functional outcomes for patients. So self-reported outcomes using iPads in the office or smartphones from home. We need to do more on developing standard and reliable methods that payers, that everyone will regard as valid ways of constructing these measures. But you can think about the kinds of things in your area of clinical practice that would be more appropriate than the volume and intensity of visits as a basis for helping you track what's really going on with care for your patients. With better measures, you can start changing the way that our financing systems and policies work. And that's what I spend the last bit of my remarks focusing on, in particular, provider payment. So I told you that I went to CMS in 2004 in conjunction with the passage of the Medicare Modernization Act, and that was definitely a big focus of the agency from during my tenure. But one of my first meetings after becoming administrator of CMS was with the heads, the CEOs of a number of large multi-specialty group practices around the country who came in to tell me about some of the innovative things that they were doing in clinical care delivery and what I would call real healthcare reform. They were doing things like implementing electronic systems to help them reach out to the population of patients they served about preventive services that were covered by Medicare, now covered free by Medicare, but that their beneficiaries often weren't using. Colorectal cancer screening, breast cancer screening, flu vaccinations and the like, where even today we're running about, you know, sort of 50-60% of covered patients in Medicare, maybe 70% using many of these services. They were doing things like implementing teams of care to support their patients with chronic diseases like diabetes and heart failure, where it wasn't just a matter of, you know, a periodic visit with a primary care physician, but they'd hired a nurse practitioner, in some cases a pharmacist, in some cases other allied health professionals, in some cases a social worker, to help reach out to patients that they had identified with these conditions who were at higher risk because they had some evidence from their electronic records that they weren't complying or they weren't adhering to their medications, or they had other characteristics that suggested they were high risk for coming back in to the emergency room or getting admitted with a complication. So they were reaching out to them and helping them with adherence, helping them with lifestyle modifications and things like that. They also were implementing steps for their major procedures, including surgical teams that were using checklists, including mechanisms involving nurses and other allied health professionals in doing the handoffs to post-acute care and rehabilitation that were intended, and they were tracking how they were reducing readmissions, reducing hospital length of stay and hospital costs, and went on and on with these examples, all of which they could show. They had, you know, they had the measures showing that they were leading to important improvements in care. And they also had some data suggesting that they were leading to lower overall costs of care. Well, the reason they were in to see me was not to just show off what they were doing, but to say, look, Mark, we're trying to do these things, but we're getting killed. And we're getting killed for two reasons. First of all, every single thing that I just mentioned was not paid for by Medicare. None of them are in fee-for-service payment systems. So you talk about, you know, going to these payment reforms, putting physicians at risk. You know, what you're at risk for is doing all these things that are really important for your patients. You're not getting paid for at all under traditional payment systems. So that's number one. We're getting killed because none of these things that we're trying to do get any direct financial support at all for Medicare. And second, to the extent that these programs work, we're actually getting reimbursed less because we have fewer visits, fewer admissions to the hospital, fewer procedures, fewer MRIs, even fewer visits to the doctors. You know, we can substitute a telemedicine or email exchange more effectively, or substitute a nurse practitioner visit for a physician visit or another allied health professional visit. And so we're billing less for the stuff that Medicare does pay for. So we cannot do these things and make ends meet in our practices. It doesn't add up. We're trying to do lean. We're trying to do other innovative ways of care delivery. It's not working financially. We have to change that. So that led to the implementation of a pilot program in Medicare called the Physician Group Practice Program, which was built around this concept of shared savings. And the idea was that if the groups, the providers working with us, could show improvements in important dimensions of quality, like some of the dimensions that I just described, these would be showing up in things like better hemoglobin A1C control for diabetic patients, fewer readmissions to the hospital, and if Medicare could see a reduction in overall spending, I'm not talking about just physician services, but in everything that Medicare paid for, Part A, Part B, all the costs, they could improve quality and lower cost trends at the same time, we would give them most of the savings after a threshold. We set the threshold at 2% for various actuarial reasons to make sure that these were real changes in trends in healthcare costs and real improvements in care. But beyond that, they got to keep 80% of the savings. The result of that program was the Physician Group Practice Initiative, which included initially 10 multi-specialty groups. This was before I or anybody had thought of the term ACO, and if you think about it, you know, the idea of an accountable care organization is not really a new one. I mean, the idea for accountable care is to set up a payment system like I just described, not necessarily a radical shift from where we are, but a second track. So the providers in these early ACOs, these physician group practices, continue to get their Medicare Part B payments. That wasn't changed at all, but in addition, there's a second payment track set up, whereby they got an additional opportunity for payment if quality improved and overall cost trends fell. And you think about this transition in payment, and you know, I keep talking about trying to get to feasible pathways to get from where we are to where we need to be. Radical change is difficult in healthcare, like anything else that people really care about, but pathways are indeed possible. What the second track does is provide a mechanism for starting to get some reimbursement for those activities that aren't being paid for now. And what many of the groups believed at the time was that they could move towards putting more of the weight, more of the emphasis in their payment systems on that second track, on getting paid for better results at a lower cost, which would in turn give them more flexibility as they got better data systems in place and more comfortable with taking on these kinds of risks as opposed to the financial risks that they were living with already, they could get more of their reimbursement through these alternative mechanisms. So moving towards maybe something more like partial capitation and the like. In the 5 years since then, 6 years since then, there have been really a rapid growth in accountable care organizations. So we have a learning network that we sponsor with Dartmouth, Elliot Fisher's group, that now has more than 100 members that are implementing ACOs, and we're by no means all of them. There are, by our best tracking, about 250 ACOs in place now. Most of these started first not with Medicare like the PGPs, but with private insurers working with provider groups to, again, set up something like that second track of payment. You know, not necessarily exactly what I described, but the basic concept of, okay, we're going to start trying to pay for what we really want. We'll do it with shared savings. We might do it with partial risk, but start tracking outcomes and other performance measures that we care about. Start tracking either overall costs or a component of costs and pay more when we get improvements in both of those dimensions. That's what's common to all these reforms. So many of them are in the private sector. Medicare now has upwards of 60 ACOs between its Pioneer program and its Medicare Shared Savings program. These now cover more than 1 million Medicare beneficiaries. There are an awful lot of startup issues with getting these programs implemented and a lot of unanswered questions still about which ones will really be most effective in improving quality. Costs. I think that the jury is definitely still out. We definitely need to get a lot more evidence. A lot of these will definitely fail, but some of them are already showing some pretty significant returns in terms of cost savings on the order of 3-4% per year and improvements in quality. And by the way, if you go back to that red chart that I put up at the beginning, what we need to do to get the red from sort of going this constantly upward angle to something that's more level and sustainable is something on the order of 1-2% per year cost savings. I don't think we're going to be able to get there just by squeezing down the prices as has been done traditionally. But a number of these programs, definitely not all of them, but a number of these ACO-type reforms seem to be able, early on, to be getting that level of reduction in cost trends. And whether that can be generalized, whether the ACOs are the way to go or something else, it's less clear. This is a slide I'll leave you to read about it in the handout. I described this as setting up a second track of payment that goes alongside fee-for-service or whatever you're starting with in your organization now, and then putting more weight on that track over time, moving away from fee-for-service as you identify the feasible path forward in clinical reforms and then match that with these payment reforms. That's what's built into the Medicare Pioneer program, where initially these organizations start out by getting a shared savings second payment track, but over time, by the third year and beyond, they're expected to put a significant part of their reimbursement, quote-unquote, at risk, meaning something like partial capitation based on getting better results and lower costs. Partial capitation means a risk from a financial standpoint if your cost per person end up being higher, but partial capitation also means more ability to move your resources to where you think they can be most useful because your payments aren't as tied as they were in the past to things like actually seeing patients in the hospital or actually doing the MRIs and so forth. More resources that can be used for things like those community-based interventions and new team approaches to care and so on. And this is just meant to be a relatively orderly and manageable transition from one to the other. Again, whether it's going to work or not, exactly in this form, not clear, but many organizations are moving down this road. I've talked a lot about ACOs. I want to emphasize that ACOs are not the whole story. There also are medical home initiatives that focus on the primary care piece of healthcare delivery by doing the same thing, making payments less tied to the volume and intensity of services provided directly to patients and more tied to things like demonstrating the ability to track patients with a chronic disease over time through a well-run registry and improving in measurable ways in the quality of care received. I think medical homes are going to work best if they can align with the same kinds of overall measures as are used in ACOs, including measures of reductions in overall costs and improvements in population health. Also, for people who are involved in specialty care, I think medical homes don't get at that directly, and the majority of spending in this country is for things like surgical procedures, activities that specialists in cardiology, GI, and so forth are involved in as well. There are a number of bundled payment reforms or episode-based payment reforms that have the same principle behind them, make the payments in these areas less tied to volume and intensity of services and more tied to things like lower overall complication rates, better patient outcomes during the procedures, lower overall costs for the whole episode of care. Again, in all these areas, it's possible to imagine these not as radical shifts from where we are now, but as kind of a step-by-step transition process, all hopefully adding up to sustainable healthcare delivery reform. If we're using consistent goals, consistent measures, consistent ways of moving from traditional fee-for-service payment to these other payment reforms, they can be reinforcing and can provide a very feasible path towards getting there. This is just a slide on what's going on in Medicaid programs now, where there will be some big changes coming, including for so-called dual-eligible beneficiaries, where CMS and where many states, again, including Republican and Democratic states, are moving to set up more integrated payment systems that get away from fee-for-service, siloed payments, and towards paying at least in part based on better results at a lower cost, even for these very challenging populations. Now, I spent almost all my time, and I'm going to wrap up in three or four or five, okay. Spent almost all my time talking about provider payment changes and talking to an audience that includes a lot of providers. Hopefully that's had some connection or at least give you something to criticize or comment on in a few minutes. I do want to emphasize that important as provider payments are and important as these changes are to some of the innovative approaches that CMS is taking today, if you look at what's going on in the private sector and even in some CMS programs, even more important may be that the patient or the consumer side of these same kinds of reforms away from policies and payments that focus on volume and intensity. And the example I want to give for you in this area is in Medicare Part D, which this will kind of reconnect what I said at the beginning. So Medicare Part D is a voluntary, individual-based private plan competitive system with no mandate for enrollment. It gives beneficiaries in Medicare a choice between a very wide range, or at least a very large number, of private entities providing prescription drug coverage. When this program was implemented, when the law was passed in 2003, it was very controversial at the time. I spent a good deal of time, I know there's some people from CMS, Barbara here in the audience, you may remember this well too, a good deal of time going out around the country talking to people in the program about what was coming. We tried to do this in a collaborative way involving a lot of opponents of the law who totally disagreed about the way that this this approach of prescribing to providing prescription drugs was being implemented, but wanted seniors to be informed. I spent a lot of time hearing from seniors about how frustrating this was. You know, why can't the government just give me a drug benefit? Why do I have to choose among 40 or 50 different plans? Why is this donut hole, all this other stuff? Very frustrating for a lot of seniors. But if you look at what happened in the program, because of a number of steps that were put in place to try to make sure that we got plans competing, despite the potential problem of adverse selection and so forth, and trying to get information to seniors, absolutely required a lot more time, a lot more effort, and was a lot more confusing for seniors than it would have been if there had been just one drug benefit. But what people ended up choosing in this system was not the traditional kind of insurance that had been envisioned in the law. In Medicare Part D, there was a standard drug benefit. This was defined in statute, which was a deductible, and then 25% coinsurance, and then catastrophic coverage on the back end. I'm sort of familiar, right? That's the way traditional insurance is designed. Now, between the catastrophic coverage and the 25% coinsurance, there's that famous donut hole where the cost of a comprehensive benefit were projected to be higher than what they turned out to be, and so there's a donut hole in there too. But, you know, traditional kind of insurance design, but for the donut hole. Do you know how many seniors today are enrolled in that kind of traditional benefit design? Almost none. The vast majority, way over 90% of seniors have chose plans when this competitive system started. They were not the traditional benefit design. They were these tiered benefit designs where basically generic drugs are free. They might cost $1 or $2 a month. For preferred brand name drugs where there's not a generic available, like at least a few years ago for cholesterol-lowering drugs, non-sedating antihistamines and the like, There may be a couple of choices. The drug plan negotiated lower prices from the manufacturer, where it's like $25 or $30 a month for those drugs. And then most other drugs have been covered. Seniors seem to like very broad formularies, but the price differential is much bigger than under traditional insurance. So what that means is, if Mrs. Smith was on a beta blocker, a brand name beta blocker, it might cost like $85 a month. If she switched to the generic version, pay $1. So it's like an $87 savings. Now, in contrast to a traditional insurance plan, she might be able to save 20, 25% of the total, maybe $15, $20 a month versus $80. Which one gives us stronger support for changing behavior, for finding a lower cost way to meet your drug needs? So while there were lots of complaints about Medicare Part D, what we were set up for was complaints about these kinds of tiered benefit design issues, because it turned out these were the most popular plans. They were offering lower premiums. Seniors were enrolling in them. And we were expecting a lot of complaints. It was like, well, I've got to pay $80 for my brand name drug. I don't want to switch to the generic. Or I've got to pay $90 for my non-preferred beta, for my non-preferred cholesterol-lowering drug. I don't want to switch to the $25 one. We never got very many complaints about those. We got a lot of complaints about the program. It's frustrating. It's too hard to enroll in. My plan doesn't know who I am, et cetera, et cetera. Real legitimate complaints, but not about these switching issues. And seniors switched medications. So the use of generic drugs has gone from about 50% beginning of 2006 to close to 80% today. Non-preferred to preferred brand name switching occurred at similar rates. And this is one reason. There are others, too, that the actual experience, the cost experience of this program is now running about 45% below what had been projected at the beginning of 2006. That's this line from the government actuaries. This is the actual experience line. And what's the point of all that? Well, I think the same thing is going to be coming to the rest of healthcare. So basically, when seniors had an opportunity to get the savings, this is a shared savings version for the consumer side, sort of the complement to what I was describing on the provider side. When seniors had the opportunity to get those savings, at least for generic drugs, generic versions of brand name drugs, and at least for versions of drugs in similar classes, they switched. They were shown with their behavior that they thought that these alternatives, much less costly, did meet their medication needs. I'm not saying it's worked perfectly in every case, but it's certainly been a hallmark of drug use in this country. Big, rapid changes, I think, are much more rapid and much more substantial than we would have seen if we just were relying on provider payment changes to try to make these changes happen. The same thing I think is going to be coming to other parts of healthcare. So there's some benefit designs now being used in the private sector where, for example, Safeway in Northern California wanted to get more effective coverage for colonoscopy. They got data on costs among all the colonoscopy providers in the area. They tried to get quality data as well. Question about how good it is, but they decided that because there's this big wide curve of costs ranging from about $500 per all in for colonoscopy related services to over $15,000, that something like $1,000 amount per colonoscopy would be adequate. And they gave their beneficiaries information on where they could go to get the colonoscopies, what the expected cost would be, and they've seen a huge shift in where people got colonoscopies and also an increase in colonoscopy utilization. With substantial cost savings at the same time. So that's the beneficiary side of these same cost change, of these same changes in focus on results that I talked about before. So instead of moving away, instead of having insurance benefits designed around fee for service, where you use more services, you get more payments, a switch to payments based on and support based on meeting your medical needs at a lower overall cost. I'm going to skip over this last slide on adverse selection just as a cautionary note, and Part D illustrates this, but the problems that we're facing I talked about earlier in my remarks about the implementation of the ACA is very relevant here too. Insurance competition and insurance choice can drive a lot of these reforms. It did in Part D. Whether that happens in the ACA remains to be seen, if the ACA is going to be implemented at all. I do think some version of competitive choice among health plans with some version of guaranteed issue and community rating is going to happen for the reasons I talked about earlier, regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court, regardless of what happens with the election. And a big challenge for us is, can we make sure that that competition is really going to be around better care at a lower cost and not around finding the healthiest beneficiaries? There's some good experience from Part D on how to try to make that happen. There's certainly a lot more we need to learn. These are some of the approaches that some of them are in the current ACA. Some of them are not, but were in the Medicare reform law. Some of them were in neither, but they all represent ways of of trying to promote effective insurance, insurance that can promote the same kind of innovation in care delivery and innovation in the policies that support it that I've been talking about today. So I'm going to end on that. I want to thank you all for listening to me, and thank you in advance for your leadership in healthcare reform, because what happens from here is by no means set. There's the traditional approach, which is trying to squeeze down prices, which has not worked in the past, is likely to be even less effective as technology is moving towards more personalized and prevention-oriented care, but also a lot of reasons for optimism, since some of the reforms that I've been talking about how to move to better care at a lower cost, how to support providers in doing that, are really working, are really starting to succeed on both the provider payment reform side and on the consumer and insurance choice side. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to join me.
Wow, Mark, thanks again. I know you felt under time pressure, and that's because it's such an easy subject to explain, and it has no complicating variables. And this is a group that's going to be sort of at the bleeding edge of all of that change. So really, spectacular job. How about one more round of applause for Mark McClellan? I didn't say it in my more formal introduction, but there's a couple of other reasons that people know why I really am so pleased that Mark could be here. First, we share two things in common that I want to point out. He, too, has twin daughters. His are a little bit younger than mine, so we were commiserating last night. And it's because of that that we see eye to eye physically. Let me ask the reactor panel members to come on up right now, please, and then I'm going to introduce them in turn. Well, while they're taking their seats, the reactor panel is a real tradition of the Grandin Lecture, and we're very appreciative of your hanging in there with us for the second part of our program. This was first really described to me by Dr. Joe Ganella, who is here today, more than 20 years ago, when he suggested that it might be fun to get faculty on and off campus and other leaders throughout the city to come and participate to sort of broaden the appeal and create some more interaction as part of the Grandin event. And this year is really no different. So let me review with you the rules of the road, and especially I hope our panel members are paying attention. So despite their best efforts, as Mark alluded to, and I could be very wealthy right now, they tried very hard to get advanced notice of the slides, and they wanted all the details, especially Rob Field from Drexel. But they heard this presentation for the first time, just like you. So what I've asked them to do is to give us their personal reflection, extemporaneous personal reflection, and to keep their comments well under 10 minutes each. Following their remarks, I hope we'll have an opportunity, maybe Mark will be able to respond, and then finally, if we have time, we'll open it up to the floor. So let me take a moment to introduce each of the panel members in turn, and we're really very thrilled that they could be here and appreciative of their taking time. So Rob Field, who is no stranger to us, Rob is, of course, a nationally known expert on health law and public health. You've read his blog and his column in the Philadelphia Inquirer. His research focuses on largely ethical issues in managed care, public policy, and a lot of the legal aspects of healthcare reform and genetic screening. Rob holds joint appointments in the School of Law and Public Health, both on the Drexel campus. Sitting next to Rob, no stranger to most of us in this audience, is Dr. Vijay Rao. Vijay is the Dave Levin Professor and Chair of the Department of Radiology here at Jefferson, and Dr. Levine is in the audience with us this morning. Vijay heads one of the top departments of radiology in the entire country, and I think, obviously, most importantly, as a female chair of such a big national department, she finds herself in sort of rarefied company. Dr. Rao herself has a longtime interest in cost-effectiveness analysis of radiologic services and has published in this area. Sitting next to Vijay is a good friend of the School of Population Health, our very own Dr. Don Schwartz, who, of course, is the health commissioner and deputy mayor for health for the city of Philadelphia. Before entering government service, Don was the vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine and deputy physician in chief and division director for adolescent medicine at CHOP. When I think I first met Don Schwartz 30 years ago, when we were both clinical scholars at Penn Medical School, it's just really wonderful to have him be a part of this program. And batting cleanup, which the Phillies could really use, is, of course, Dr. Mark Tikashinsky. So Mark is the Anthony F. and Gertrude M. DePalma Dean, Senior Vice President of Jefferson and President of Jefferson University Physicians. Not only does Mark serve as Dean and President of the Faculty Practice Plan, but really on our campus is effectively our top clinical leader for the university. On a personal note, I want to really thank Mark. He has been a wonderful supporter of our school. Wherever he goes, he talks about what we're up to, and I am very grateful to him. Okay, so that's the lineup. So, Rob, you're the hit-off batter. You're the lead-off hitter. We hope that you'll do a great job. Give us your extemporaneous reaction. Then we're going to go right down the line, BJ, Don, and Mark, and then we'll take questions. Fire away.
I should be the Jimmy Rollins of the...
There you go. You're it.
So I appreciate these will be extemporaneous. I tried every which way I could to get an advanced copy of the slide. These guys have the most stringent privacy settings on all their web pages, and it was just not possible. So, however, I wanted to pick up on what Mark talked about in connection with the Supreme Court and the politics of health reform, which is what I've been following most closely. The Supreme Court ruling will obviously be important for healthcare. It could also be tremendously important for constitutional law. And so there are different gradations for what we may get from them. The sense of this group is pretty much the sense that I have, that they're very, very likely to strike down the mandate, perhaps some of the provisions immediately associated with that involving the individual insurance market, probably not more than that. But I think it's certainly within the field of play that they will go further, and this could be a watershed for constitutional law in a couple of ways. First of all, there are really four cases which were heard separately over the course of 3 days. The Anti-Injunction Act, which basically says that the court can't decide the case because it's a form of taxation, which won't go into effect until 2014, so go away and come back once you've been taxed. From the tenor of the questioning, it seems very unlikely they'll put this aside. Also, politically, even though the court isn't supposed to look at that, I think it would be very tough for them to generate all this anticipation and then say, never mind, we'll deal with this later. The individual mandate is what's gotten most of the attention. Going up to the arguments, people were thinking 50-50, they might uphold it, they might strike it down. I was fortunate enough to be able to attend those hearings in connection with my work for the Inquirer. It was the first day that the justices really tipped their hands as to what they might be thinking in connection with the tenor of their questioning. And I think it was pretty clear that the five more conservative justices were going to vote to strike it down. I was struck with how consistent their antagonism was. They did ask some challenging questions. Some of them did, Roberts in particular, when it came to the attorneys who were challenging the law. But I thought they were much more impassioned going after Donald Varelli, the Solicitor General. Interestingly, the former liberal justice seemed just as impassioned in trying to support him and help him make his case, but of course there's four of them and five of the others. I was particularly struck with Justice Kennedy, who people think of as the swing vote, and how dubious he seemed of Varelli's arguments. He kept coming back to the notion of creating commerce. You can regulate interstate commerce, but was this creating commerce? And then there's a debate as to whether or not it is. So that brings us to the severability issue, which I think is really the big issue here. Is the court going to have a narrow ruling that just strikes down the mandate and associated provisions, or is it going to go after the entire law? And I was quite surprised that the questioning the next day, at least they entertained the idea of striking down the entire law. That, of course, could cause chaos. There are so many provisions in there, many of them totally unrelated to the mandate, including generic versions of biotechnology drugs, the consumer protections, Medicare reforms, student loans, which have already gone into effect at least partially. But they indicated that they were at least open to that. And then finally, the Medicaid expansion, which almost no legal scholars thought had any traction, that was not upheld by a single court below that the justices seriously entertained going after. So what are the likely outcomes? If the court strikes down the mandate, which I think is likely, it's most likely there'll be a narrow ruling, but a broad ruling could actually redefine Congress's power to regulate economic activity. Since the New Deal, there's been a doctrine that Congress has extremely broad powers. There have been only two cases in recent decades, really since the 30s, where the court has struck down laws under the Commerce Clause. One was the Guns in School Zones Law. The other was the Violence Against Women Act, which they said were intrastate commerce, and that's why Congress didn't have the ability to do it. They didn't cross state lines. They have never struck down a Commerce Clause law based on the remedy, based on the regulatory scheme. So this would be a first, whichever way they go there, but this could significantly cut back the ability of Congress to do anything in health and safety, which would be a watershed and a change in the federal-state relationship with regard to all of health care. In terms of Medicaid, it could be a similar watershed ruling. The argument against it is that federal government can spend money, attach strings, but at some point those strings become coercive, so it's sort of backdoor regulation. Is the change in Medicaid, adding all the additional beneficiaries, even though the federal government will pay almost all that cost, is that coercing the states? Likelihood is the court will not buy that argument. If they were to, you have to ask, is that so much more coercive than Medicaid is right now? And could this ruling actually jeopardize our legal framework for Medicaid, which would give Congress basically the choice of something like block grants or nothing? So that could also be a watershed. How is Congress going to react to that? I think one of the dynamics that needs to be borne in mind is the importance of industry in this. Obama got the law passed largely because he was able to bring the insurance industry, pharma, on board, and they had opposed the Clinton plan, in addition to hospitals and many physician groups. I think they have a stake in this, and they will want to see significant portions of this retained. So whether it's a question of Congress looking to repeal it or Congress looking to reinstate parts that the court has struck down, I think that factor will be extremely important. Two final points. One is a poignant irony that if the court does issue a broad ruling and say that Congress can't expand Medicaid, that Congress cannot mandate coverage as a way of dealing with the individual market, then whenever Congress revisits this at some time in the future, what will be the one option that is clearly constitutional? Well, that would be a single-payer Medicare for All type plan. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But it is sort of clearing the way in saying, if you want to deal with this, here's the path. Medicare, that's it. And then finally, I was struck in watching the arguments, and I'm sure many of you read this in the papers and the press, at how poor a job the Solicitor General Donald Borelli seemed to do. He was very nervous. He coughed. He spilled water. He started his presentation twice. And he really missed some important arguments. He was ill-prepared to define the Commerce Clause and explain the limits of congressional power. And this seemed to continue with the arguments the following day. It struck me that this is a theme with this law. The administration has done an awful job communicating to the public from day one, from the day it was passed. You look at other health reforms, communication was the key to the rollout. In Massachusetts, Romney used the Boston Red Sox, used community groups to explain it and roll it out. Medicare Part D was a very complex plan. Mark was largely responsible for communicating that and implementing what was eventually a successful rollout. Medicare itself was an incredibly complicated law, something brand new. There was a major federal effort lasting the better part of a year to roll that out. So I think if you want to look at the future of this law, look at the communication strategy, if there is one, of the administration, both to the public and both legally, because that's going to be the key to what happens.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Rob. Great job. Dr. Rao.
Great. First of all, it's wonderful to be here to have this opportunity. Really enjoyed Mark's talk tremendously, very stimulating and incredibly comprehensive. And I think he told us that clearly we all have something that we know, the spending on healthcare is driving federal deficits. And what I heard from Mark was really a call to action for physicians, for a new type of leadership, if you will, and to really make a difference, reform the delivery care model, and which requires a huge culture change for us. I think in defining pathways, you know, how do we reduce the costs? Clearly, when the public hears all about how much spending there is and how much cost reduction, and they hear about rationing, and Mark told us clearly, so we need to really, physicians have to take the leadership here to see how we can improve quality and reduce costs. We have practiced an environment that has actually rewarded volume rather than value, and I think we need to move towards value. There are a lot of opportunities for us to do that, and being a radiologist, you know, what comes to my mind clearly is all the excess testing and procedures that are done, and certainly we've been in the CMS's crosshairs for a while, the imaging tests. And I think there's a huge opportunity here to really work together to develop evidence-based guidelines to really avoid waste in healthcare. An initiative that was recently launched by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation in concert with 9 other specialties, they put out a list of 45 tests that are accessibly used, and there's huge opportunity there to reduce the number of tests. And I hate to tell you that 24 out of those 45 are actually related to imaging. You know, there's some overlap because, there was American College of Cardiology, American College of Radiology, Clinical Oncology, and so on and so forth. So many specialties, you know, participated in this. I think for us to be able to achieve this, A, culture change, number 2 is implementation. And this is where the challenge comes, you know, for any type of change. We need to leverage technology. We need to have technology where we have built-in evidence-based guidelines that can be linked to order entry to minimize these testing or to do the appropriate testing is really where we need to get. And those evidence-based guidelines have to be able to hold in the court of law. Practicing in this area in Philadelphia market, as a practicing physician, it's hard for me not to bring up the fact that our malpractice costs are incredibly high. And you know, for us to really base all our decisions on evidence-based guidelines, these have to be vetted, and there has to be some teeth behind these guidelines for us to reduce costs. So similarly, there are other things that can be done. In the outpatient market, as you know, the commercial payers have already deployed some of these. So they are already using pre-certification, RBMs, right, to control utilization. And they have shown that actually utilization can be controlled and the costs can be lowered. However, I don't know, when you look at commercial payers, you know, the medical loss ratio is about 60% to 65%, and in the Affordable Care Act, there's actually a provision which says that their medical loss ratio should go up to 80% to 85%, so we'll have to wait and see what happens to that. I think the other thing I heard from Mark was new payment models. And I think the driving force behind that is really creating more collaboration and working together as teams, the physicians, you know, all the specialists and the physicians with the hospital, and putting the patient first. We need to do the right thing, you know, right thing for the patient. And complexity adds a lot of costs. And I can tell you, I mean, listening to this lecture, I mean, it's really mind-boggling the amount of information to absorb that quickly. And I have to say what Robert said earlier. If you want to make it simple, make it a single payer. take out all this complexity, and that'll reduce costs tremendously, but we know that'll never happen. So the challenge to the physicians is really to improve quality, to put patient first, to really see how we can come together and add value to what we are doing, and which means we are moving from volume-based reimbursements or reward to value-based reward system. So I think that's sort of where I would say I would leave it.
Excellent.
Thank you.
BJ, thank you. Don.
Thanks, David. And I have to say, from someone who's now worked for government for a few years, in Philadelphia, the partnership with Jefferson has been wonderful, and your leadership has.
Thank you.
So I thank you for that publicly with your peers. I want to commend Mark for setting a frame that is one of what I need to talk about as many frames that can be set around where do we go with healthcare reform. So what we heard, and I'll comment a little on that, is a frame that's focused on Medicare. And much of health reform is focused on Medicare. Remember that we're talking about largely a piece of federal legislation that is enacted and impacted through states. But the federal government has jurisdiction over Medicare. It's fascinating that we don't think of Medicare as an individual mandate, although we all pay for it in our taxes. And that as a result, much of the debate, much of the discussion in healthcare reform has been about Medicare. But I work and represent Philadelphia. I have, over the last 4 years, been involved in talking about, figuring out, and thinking about how healthcare reform will impact Philadelphia. And certainly over the last year, spent a fair amount of time thinking about what happens and what are the outcomes if there is inappropriate action and decision-making by the Supreme Court. And I have lots of thoughts about that. One thing that I want to start with in terms of setting a frame is that remember much of healthcare reform, although there is public pressure for healthcare reform, much of the real pressure, push, and I think financing of the debate around healthcare reform came from the business sector, where increasing proportions of private profit are eaten up by healthcare benefit costs. That pressure isn't going to go away. And if we, both on the Democratic and Republican side, whatever happens, continue to push for portability of insurance without an individual mandate, what that will do, I believe, is put increased pressure on businesses to provide coverage to people so that people are in the insurance market. That pressure on business to be in the insurance market means that we have a change from what we currently have, which is businesses reducing their commitment to dependent coverage. And if that happens and more people are in through businesses, the cost of business goes up. So I wonder what's going to happen in terms of pressure back from business on government to solve this problem, which won't have been solved. And we could say, as is suggested, that the pressure will come on reducing healthcare costs. I don't want to debate that we need to reduce healthcare costs. I don't want to debate that we need to improve quality, because hopefully we all are part of that conversation. But how we reduce cost and how we improve quality, I think, is the center of where we're going to go, and we're going to have increasing pressure, we all need to realize it, from the business sector to do that. Improving quality is a challenge. You guys know better than I do what the challenge is, both in terms of hurting the cats who practice care and hurting the cats who receive care. We're not really good at changing behavior without doing it through financial means. And Mark is an economist, and I like economic models. We can provide incentives for rapid change in behavior through financial change. And I think we would all be naive to think that won't happen in one way or another. At some point, the only counter pressure against payment reform is going to be the proportion of the workforce, I think, that is in the healthcare sector. So in Philadelphia, we are very worried, not just at Jefferson, but across the city, about what the impact is on the 63,000 people who are employed in the healthcare sector in Philadelphia when payment changes to healthcare institutions. And I don't see a way for it to get any plusher for institutions in town. There are a number of places that I think are very likely to close very quickly. There'll be some consolidation, but simply loss of jobs and loss of beds in Philadelphia, no matter what happens with healthcare reform. That means more unemployment. That means changes in what has been an expectation of employment in Philadelphia in healthcare. And I think that changes the face of Philadelphia. And I have to tell you, the mayor is really worried about whatever happens with healthcare reform. What does the future in Philadelphia look like for the average Philadelphia workforce? One observation. Two is, I want to talk a bit about Medicaid since we focused on Medicare. I'm worried that the greatest loss that we will suffer, and I'll make a political comment since I work for a political person, is that should the White House change and should both houses of Congress be Republican, we won't have Medicaid. I think it's pretty clear that the entitlement will go down. In Philadelphia, that's going to impact all of us. It will impact the face of the city, it will impact many Philadelphians, and it will impact anyone who works in the healthcare sector in Philadelphia, and I think probably pretty mightily. About the only winner will likely be the state of Pennsylvania, where Pennsylvania, along with a bunch of other states, have asked to have a waiver of one provision of the ACA, which wasn't mentioned, which is the maintenance of effort requirement. So states are required until 2014 not to drop anyone who is eligible for Medicaid insurance where there's a dollar going in of federal support. And that has preserved the Medicaid program eligibility in Pennsylvania. The minute that there is a comprehensive challenge, either from Congress or the court, to health reform, that maintenance of effort requirement, I believe, goes away, and we'll see wholesale loss of Medicaid coverage for people. And I'm very worried about that. And I think that is a picture of where we go from here that could be bleak for the city and probably bleak for the country. And the final is a comment about what's not happening in healthcare reform. And if we want to save money, and we believe in financial incentives, there are a whole bunch of things that weren't in healthcare reform because Congress didn't take them on because they were too politically contentious, or there were specific compromises that prevented them from happening. For instance, in my world now, we don't talk about cost savings and other things. We talk about return on investment, because both the federal government and the state government want to know that if we spend a public dollar, we have a return on that investment that is at least as great or at least as big as it can be. Well, if we look at public activity that would have a great benefit in terms of the health of the American public, it would be increasing the cost of tobacco in America.
Amen.
If you want to, or we want to, for instance, reduce low birth weight birth, we have not in Philadelphia had a change in the rate of low birth weight birth in more than half a century. Despite decreasing infant mortality rates, despite improvements in care, despite all sorts of things, the rate of low birth weight birth has not gone down. And low birth weight birth is one of the big drivers of pediatric health care costs because we invest a lot in sick babies. Well, the only intervention that in the short term has been shown to reduce low birth weight birth is increasing substantially the cost of tobacco. And that was discussed as part of healthcare reform, and it was rejected almost immediately. A second thing that we believe could potentially reduce healthcare cost in the short run in America is higher cost and less subsidy for high fructose corn syrup enriched beverages. A tax on sugar sweetened beverages was included as one of the provisions initially proposed to finance health care reform, and it was rejected by the White House because of lobbying from the industry. We could increase our investments in education. Public education is one of the surest ways, if we look around the world, to decrease long-term health care expenditures. We could provide housing, take dollars currently invested in health care and provide housing for the very high-cost members of society who over a very long period of time depend on the health system because when they leave the health system, they have no decent place to live. But we've chosen not to make those policy decisions, although many of them were considered in health care reform. So where we go from here, I think, should consider, and I hope considers, whatever the Supreme Court does and whatever the country does in terms of the election, I hope we think about broader cost-saving measures that actually would improve the health of the American people as a whole and reduce health care expenses.
Great. Don, thank you. Okay, Mark, thank you.
Well, this was really dangerous, agreeing to be on a panel with a health policy speaker, health policy experts, when you really don't know all that much about health policy. So really all I can do is take the fact that I'm the dean here seriously and speak from a very parochial standpoint. So I think Mark's presentation was wonderful, but he is sitting in an academic medical center. I might point out one that is part of a health system that Thomson Reuters ranked as among the top five in the country about a month ago, based on outcomes measures, et cetera, and our flagship hospital is a key part of that health system. But there was really no discussion of what does this really mean to academic medical centers, what does it mean to med schools and their survivability. And really, as I look at the debate on the national level, the discussion seems to be very siloed. So you have a AAMC, which is perhaps the most important organization looking after the med schools in the country. And it has its one approach, but that really hasn't dovetailed very much. And I think AAMC itself is spending most of its time looking to portray itself as the ultimate citizen, to work with CMS, to work with the governmental agencies. And it keeps a lot of its other advocacy in a very siloed way, in lobbying NIH, et cetera, but never really articulating the larger question, which is what happens to the academic medical centers and the medical schools as healthcare reform plays out, regardless of its totality of the Affordable Care Act, or even if it's in parts of it. And I think there's just certain implicit assumptions that one has to question. You know, the one implicit assumption is, well, if the academic medical centers sort of behave properly, they rein in those errant physicians, and they start doing things according to clinical pathways and therapeutic and diagnostic pathways, there will be more money, and somehow all will be well, and those medical centers will survive. I'm not sure it's quite that simple. I think in a sense, when we talk about all these goods, and I do fully support them in terms of value-based purchasing, et cetera, if you really step back, and in my humble view, you're really talking about taking a Darwinian survival, fittest of survival, and you're taking that to a whole other level. I mean, in some ways, it magnifies the stressors of just plain marketplace competition, but it also sets certain key ground rules. And I think once you start pegging reimbursements in very material ways, it will fundamentally create winners among medical centers and losers among the medical centers. And, you know, perhaps in towns like ours where you have a proliferation of medical schools and medical centers, one more or one less would be survivable. But I think there's a question out there in parts of the country where there is one medical school, one medical center, often covering more than one state. What happens if some don't adapt in this Darwinian survival and don't make it through? How is it going to be brought through? And so I think the rapidity in which changes are being implemented and the financial structures are changing really has to factor in an issue of survivability. The other thing that I would say is clearly the financial business, you know, the business model for the clinical enterprise, the academic medical center, can no longer continue as it has. So that, and that's what the Affordable Care Act and others are really touching on. But at the same time, the academic business model is dead. And we thought it would take, I personally thought it might take about 5 years to transition. It is literally transitioning in front of our eyes. If you look at the recent announcement from Donna Shalala, you know, who heads up the Miller Medical School at University of Miami with all these layoffs of research scientists over there, this is impacting very quickly. And the question, and even at its best, I would say, even if we adapt to the new clinical model, there's unlikely to be the kind of extra margin to cross-subsidize the academic mission. And someone in Washington, somewhere, has to think about both of these elements for the academic medical center. How are you going to both, you know, take efficient clinical enterprises, academic medical centers, and at the same time sustain these places when you're at single-digit percentiles for the research enterprise? And and I think when we're talking about, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, that academic enterprise is pennies on the dollar. And I'm not sure that case has been made as effectively as it could. You know, going taking an NIH budget from 30 million to 40 million or 45 could make the world of difference and not, you know, give away 65 years of post-war triumph of American medicine and putting us at a point where we are now where we literally cannot recruit postdocs, new faculty out of postdocs. We can't afford the risk, by and large, to launch new careers. And this is playing itself out across the city, across the state. And I have my colleague who's in a key leadership position in the city of Philadelphia. And let me tell you, we are now in ultra-hyper competition in this marketplace. To crazy levels. And I would argue that if we're going to get government involvement, government should be creating policies that incentivize those places that have multiple medical centers to be working with each other as opposed to competing with each other. And that should be not only in terms of the clinical enterprise, but certainly, you know, there's going to be some competition, and I would use Wharton's co-opetition model that we might find ways to cooperate and compete. But certainly on the academic side, putting us in positions where we're not partnering and actually competing against each other is really creating no good for our city and really burning up a lot of energy. The only other point I would make, and I do have to pick up on Vijay's point, and it seems peripheral to this discussion, but I don't think it's peripheral, and certainly not for the city of Philadelphia. The malpractice environment in the county of Philadelphia makes it impossible, will make survivability of our Pennsylvania institutions and certainly the ones in Philadelphia County particularly problematic. And it is the only political, I like to say apolitical in all of this, but you know, there has to be some movement on this issue, and it may have to be some interplay at the federal level and at things that are happening at the state level. But I love the comment that, you know, the phrase, which I'm now going to adopt, that Mark made, which was we're moving into a medicine that is increasingly predictable and personalized medicine. I hadn't heard that predictable part. But really, in order to do that and to be the drivers of that, we can't do that in this kind of, you know, punitive malpractice environment where you know, we can't do any of the things that we're going to need to do in order to create the pathways and to be efficient in terms of all the diagnostics. And then the very last point I would make is we are going to have to, and here now wearing my hat as president of Jefferson University Physicians, part of rethinking the business model under the healthcare reform is really going to be what is the life of physicians, not just the ones we're training in med school, but the ones that are out there. We see, you know, ironically, a mass knocking on the door now of docs out there in the community who are trying to find the cover of the academic medical center. So I just went on about all the stressors and the financial stressors of the AMC, but as tough as it is here, it's even tougher and impossible to live on the outside. And so part of rethinking the business model for the academic medical center is also going to be an issue of what is our relationship, what is the size of our internal physician groups, what is the relationship of the community physicians to us, what is the titration between the subspecialty medicine that we think is unique to us at the highest level, but at the same time, knowing we have a key role in primary care, and it's not the same size fits all. It's the solution of how the interface on the healthcare continuum plays out at non-academic medical centers. It has to be fundamentally different, and yet I don't think the policies and coordination are there to really address those needs.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mark. Mark McClellan, can you do a 5-minute reaction?
Sure.
And then we'll wrap up on schedule.
Let me come on back up, and I want to thank all the commenters for some excellent perspectives on the topics that I just was able to touch upon in my remarks. This is really hard, and it's also really controversial, and some of the big ideas that people have are going to be difficult to implement because of political controversies, because differences in philosophical outlooks. But that's all the more reason for what Vijay said, which is, I think Mark echoed, which is need physician and clinician leadership in these debates in a way that, I guess to be blunt, I don't think has happened effectively before. There are a lot of big challenges facing physicians today, and those are not going to get easier. I know we need to go back and debate about forgiving the SGR for next year somehow. I know there needs to be progress on liability reform, but those can't be reasons to stay out of this debate, and quite the opposite. Leadership on this debate, I think, will help make it possible to get credibility and get more change on some of those other key issues. Just a few other specific comments. Bob's analysis of the Supreme Court outlook was terrific. I'd be a little bit more charitable to the Solicitor General in that, I think he was in a tough spot. I would kind of argue that, basically make the argument that there are limits on the Commerce Clause when it comes to health care, and was trying to say, this is not about regulating eating broccoli or other lifestyle issues and so forth. But to Don's point, I mean, those are important issues for determining our healthcare costs. And as I talked about in some of my, I gave some examples of health insurers and employers who are now building in provisions related to stopping smoking, taking other steps to live a healthier lifestyle into their financial incentives and benefit designs. And that's probably a good thing because that is where you can really have the impact. And I don't think it makes the argument before the Supreme Court that there are limits on this commerce power any easier. His point is it's a tough, he was in a tough spot, and I definitely empathize with him. On liability reform, even when sort of the strongest advocates for liability reform at the federal level, President Bush and Republican leaders were in control in 2004 to 2006, there were lots of proposals for federal liability reform then. They couldn't even get a majority vote. A lot of Republicans on the sort of states' rights issue thought that that was not an appropriate federal jurisdiction. I think the point being that there are some promising ideas out there for liability reform. It unquestionably makes a difference. Probably action on that is going to have to come at least in part at the state level. And if there are some real problems here in Pennsylvania, there's some models in other states to look towards, not just caps on damages, but presumptions around evidence-based guidelines, steps that, like Florida, is considered to move from the traditional judicial process to something more like a workers' comp or kind of scheduled arrangement or expert court arrangement. So there's some models out there that I think could have bipartisan support, but probably aren't going to be done at the federal level alone. I certainly agree with Don's points about the importance of community interventions, the importance of lifestyle changes. While attacks at the federal level on high fructose corn syrup may not be in the cards, there certainly are a lot of examples where state programs and others have tried to support more community-based interventions. So, we've been working a lot, and I think you all have too, some with Jeff Brenner and New Jersey in taking steps to turn what had been healthcare funding for emergency room care and uncompensated care into community-based interventions to help people living in high-risk areas under very difficult circumstances get what they need to prevent the healthcare complications, whether it's adhering to their medications or more reliable housing support, housing vouchers, and the like. So I think there is some reason for optimism there. And other area where there clearly are a lot of challenges is in the academic medical centers, Mark. And we've got in our ACO Learning Network a subgroup of academic centers that are kind of going down the ACO route and are dealing with exactly the kind of difficult struggles that you've described. It's not easy. One of the big challenges is how to get the federal support for academic centers updated into this new era. We still have federal support for GME tied to intern and residents to beds, not tied to anything like the way healthcare is delivered today, let alone the way it should be with the kind of physician leadership that we need. And I hope there will continue to be some leadership from these groups that we're working with and the AMC and you on how to do it. I can't say we've come up with the solutions yet. These groups are doing things like finding ways to redirect funding for their uncompensated care towards more community-based services, realigning the way that their practices are designed, as you were just describing, with, you know, kind of rethinking their relationship to community hospitals and physicians who are in service and getting more alignment and the financial support and so forth across those areas. But it certainly isn't easy. And again, that's back to the reasons for physician leadership. And lest anyone think that single-payer countries have solved all these problems, or remember the United Kingdom is right now in the midst of implementing a set of steps that are going to move them in more of a public-private direction and towards more accountability based on value because of a lot of dissatisfaction in the UK about the quality of costs that they're getting for what they're spending. And I think there's probably, if anything, going to be some more convergence across countries and moving in some of the directions that we've talked about today.
Wonderful.
Thank you all very much.
Well, colleagues, indulge me for less than five more minutes. So first, I want to really thank Mark McClellan and our panel members. I also want to take a moment to point out the incredible team effort that a day like today is what it takes, and thank especially Alexis Skoufalos, Darlene Sheaf, the entire continuing education team. I want to thank my colleagues on the dean's staff, Alexis, Carolyn, Mark Legnini, David Glatter, our program directors, Drs. Cash, Abatamarco, Pellegrino, Simmons, and Jackson. Without these people, none of this would be possible. Finally, I hope you'll return to this setting on Thursday, July 19th at 10 o'clock, when our school will have once again our annual summer seminar and the debut of the Grandin Society, a membership society that we've created with the development office here on campus to help promote interprofessional education, collaboration, and innovation. I hope you'll grab a brochure from our beautiful booth in the lobby. And finally, I hope, God willing, we'll all be back together at the 22nd Grandin Lecture. Thank you for coming. We stand adjourned.